Welcome to Designing for the Greater Good, a health and safety in design podcast series developed and presented by the Canterbury Safety Charter and the Professional Services Working Group. My name is Paul Duggan, and I will be leading you through a series of interviews with leading professionals in the industry answering the following questions. What is health and safety by design? How can it be used? What are the costs and the benefits? And why have you not heard about it? Tune in to find out, is good design designing for the greater good? Today, I'm here with Kristen Hoskin, and we're talking about health and safety by design, a little bit about the history, and also about the legacy. So, Kristen, perhaps you could start by telling us who you are and what you do.
My name's Kristen, of course. I work for a company called Advisian. It's part of the Worley Group, and my role is in safety and risk. So I provide consulting services in risk across the board, but mostly we have a safety focus.
Okay, Kristen, from a personal perspective, what does health and safety mean to you?
For me, health and safety is about doing things sensibly and making sure that we're not creating a burden and trying to implement a safe process to achieve the outcomes we're after.
Mm-hmm. And where does design sit? What's your definition of design?
Design to me is pretty much planning and making sure that when we go about doing something, we take our vision and we turn it into something tangible that pretty much stays on path with what we're after.
So if we take the old army maxim of prior planning prevents poor performance, is this where you see the two health and safety and design coming together?
I think so. I think when you're doing things sensibly and when you're doing things safely, they should marry. If they don't marry, then you haven't done it right.
So can you tell us a little bit about the history of health and safety by design? And I guess the focus of this unit is more on the building and construction industry, but I understand that's not where this process originated.
No. I mean, health and safety has obviously been a big focus for us since the earthquakes, but it's been a focus in many engineering industries for a very long time. Mostly, I think it's probably been formalised in the process engineering fields, and it's got a legacy that probably dates back well over 100 years now. Some of the examples that people are probably familiar with are the way that we design plugs and sockets so that people can't, or children can't, stick forks in the socket in the wall, and also things like the safety match, which was designed as a safety match because people were having problems with matches lighting up in their pockets back in the 1800s. So it goes back a long way.
So how did that design change the way matches were used? I mean, I can't imagine it. No experience of a match self-igniting in someone's pocket, but how did that work?
Phosphorus was what was used to make the strike a match, and it took very little to set it off. So a little bit of friction was all that was required, whereas now you actually have to apply proper friction to set them off.
Oh, well, no, very fascinating. Can you give us some examples of the work you've been involved in involving health and safety by design?
So some of the work I've done has been in facilitation of safety and design workshops, looking at some of the things that people want to consider but haven't really got a handle on before they start a project. And in other cases, it's been about aspects where there's a legacy of a structure or that needs to come down or needs to be modified, and there isn't adequate documentation to really understand what was intended by the designers when it was built. Mm-hmm. So some of the examples involved roadways and looking at some of the things that have been earthquake damage related. We've also had some projects that look at simple things such as the junction boxes on the sides of roads and how those have been designed for opening and for maintenance purposes, and whether there's a way to do those better so that both the pedestrians and the workers and the traffic are all in a safer space. Mm-hmm. There's other things that we've also looked at, some of the environmental aspects that also come into this, the process safety and how processes will fail safely.
I guess designing to fail safely seems like a bit of a anachronism in that you want to design things safely and design them not to fail. But I guess that's an additional step, isn't it? We're thinking, okay, let's turn it around now and see what things you know, could fail, and can we design a way to make them fail safely? That seems like a complete 180 degrees from, I guess, traditional ways of looking at projects.
That's the way that we look at things. So when you're looking at earthquake engineering, you want the building to stay up and last. Previously, we wanted the building to stay up and last long enough for people to get out, and that was as far as we went.
Okay.
Now we look at designing buildings so that they stay up long enough for people to get out and are still going to be safe enough that you can repair them rather than have to demolish them.
In Christchurch, that is very significant then, and I guess has a lot of learnings for other cities that also are in earthquake zones.
It applies for fire engineering too.
Where do you see the tensions between the different lots of people, I guess, the designers, the safety consultants like yourself, the people who are going to be using either the structures or the projects? Where do the tensions come in that they've got different ideas of what it should be like and how it should look and how it should function?
I think there's a lot of areas where tension can arise, and they need to be overcome through proper communication about risks. Risks shouldn't just be looked at as opportunities for the bills to get bigger in terms of building something. They're also a mechanism by which you can create a legacy for the structure so that it's going to be easier to maintain and be more cost-effective for the maintenance in the long run. When people are starting to get into the safety and design process, they might be focusing on the little details, some of them. Other people might be worried about how their vision is going to change because they've got a vision for what this building is going to look like at the end of the day. You can bring both of those together, but it's got to be a collaborative process, and you really want to make sure that the most important group is represented, and that's the users, whether the users are the occupants or whether the users are the people who are going to be doing the maintenance. In many cases, it's both, because if you can't maintain a structure safely, then it's going to be a problem.
Yes. We spoke before this interview about the life cycle of a building being 50 years, and where do you sit on that as a time frame for a structure?
I think that that's a reasonable assessment. We don't know what's going to happen with buildings. When you were designing a building in 1970, you wouldn't have been anticipating that you were going to be putting a whole pile of cables through it. That was not any of the elements of services that you would be even thinking about. You'd have the electricity to a few points, and that would be it. Now we've got massive cable trays being installed in buildings. We don't know what the future holds. There could be all sorts of changes that are going to happen in 100 years. So let's just focus on 50, because I think we can pretty much forecast what might be coming up there.
My argument, I guess, would be, why can't we make a building last for 500 years rather than 50, in that it doesn't have to be pulled down. It would be, stable, we hope, and that it would be able to be used and leave a legacy. But you're saying something completely different. And what are the arguments for that?
Well, there's a couple of arguments. One is that the users are going to change. There's very few buildings that are going to, other than residential buildings, that are going to be in the same usage 50 years from now. What might be a retail outlet today could well be a restaurant in 3 years' time, and it might be an accommodation venue shortly after that. So buildings are repurposed very, very frequently. So it's difficult to accommodate all of those aspects. The other thing is our expectations of what is safe work also change. So in Christchurch, for example, there's a lot of very steeply pitched housing roofs. There's a lot of other roofs that have got no roof access. People weren't anticipating that there was going to be any problem just sticking your ladder up and going and working on that roof. Now we expect anchor points or some sort of scaffolding to be installed. It becomes a very costly venture. Maybe in the future we'll be using drones. One of the things that's definitely on the horizon is the use of self-cleaning windows. So you may not need to accommodate for anchor points and things in the future if you've got a glass building.
So you talk about the 1970s and then the use of cabling extensively now. Where do you see as the next technological shift that we need to start possibly thinking about now, even for the next 10 or 20 years?
At the moment, one of the big focuses is on being environmentally friendly and trying to find solutions that are creating less waste. So by going about that approach, we're probably going to be looking to remove a lot of the things that we've currently got installed and finding more ecologically friendly solutions. That's probably going to have an impact. The amount of ventilation that's required, so currently we might have quite a lot of heat generation and a lot of heat loss in our buildings. We want to probably be trying to conserve that, and that's going to have some aspects that are going to come into design as well.
Less air circulation from the outside, is that sort of what I'm hearing?
There'll be less transition of heat from the interior to the exterior, and so you're going to have greater insulation within the structure, but at the same time you're likely to have less heat generation from specific elements within the building. You're not using the gas heaters that perhaps might have been used in the past. You're not using the radiant heaters that you used in the past. We're going to be using new things that are more efficient, more effective, and hopefully those are designed more safely as well.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about health and safety by design for existing buildings? Because I guess, you know, this is a relatively new thing in New Zealand, and there's a lot of buildings which are older, and as you've said, I guess the use changes quite frequently. What should people be thinking about when they, you know, repurpose a building at the moment?
So one of the things that we've got is there's a lot of legislation that helps us with that. So when you're repurposing a building, there may be some regulations, particularly related to fire, that you'll need to comply with. But you can think a little bit more broadly. So there was an example, a building that I was working with not too long ago, and they were basically taking two buildings and creating one through building a bridging structure. When we looked at that, both of the individual buildings had anchor points on the roof. Neither of those buildings need those anchor points now because there is no fall risk. It's a solid roof. Anchor points need to be maintained and inspected on an annual basis, so we can reduce a huge amount of OPEX by taking that out when they were doing that.
So
construction.
Good health and safety by design actually makes economic sense even for retrofitting, not for new buildings.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you see as the key learnings from your experience for someone who is starting out on a health and safety by design process?
I think the key thing for people to just bear in mind is it's an iterative process. When you start off with safety and design, you will probably come up with a huge list, and that list might shrink. You may think of some aspects of design that you want to change that are going to eliminate some risks. And then as you progress through the design process, you'll probably find more sensible decisions that you can make. The key thing is to document them. So whether you're running a workshop on safety and design or whether you're just iteratively changing the way that you do your business with your building, the key things are to note that down and put it with the operations manual so that future people will have a reference and they'll know, I can't cut a doorway in that wall because I've got a structural wall, or there's a whole pile of cables run through that, or it's got some other element that makes that a problem. Other things that people might be wanting to do is install an elevator. There could be some issues around that too, based on where they can put that in the building. But you don't know that if you don't know what the building's made of, what the designers were thinking, and what were the limitations that were being considered at that time.
Mm-hmm. So who do you see as the key drivers for health and safety by design? Is it the clients, is it the architects, or is it the end users?
I think it should be the clients. I don't know that it is, though. At the moment, I think it's more the architects and engineers that are driving this. And the reason I say it should be the clients is that they're not going to want to keep this building for 50 years. They're going to want to sell it at some point. And the people who are going to buy it are going to want a building they can use and that's not going to cost them a lot of money to maintain. So by thinking about your future users, the future owners, and what the operational costs are going to be, and the adaptability of the building, what its function can be changed to, then the client is going to get a better product they're going to get something they can sell easier. Mm-hmm. They're going to get something that people want to work in.
Mm-hmm. So really it's about education of the clients and seeing this as a cost-to-benefit ratio, that if you spend this time and this money thinking about this process now, actually you get the benefit when you come to sell it.
Yes, definitely. It's all about creating a better product for a better return at the end of the day.
So if you had a magic wand and could wave it in the industry, what would you like to see change at the moment?
Oh, I would like to see people write down a lot more things. There's nothing worse than having the drawings for a structure and then you do all your site survey, you go to dig and you find a pipeline that you didn't know was there. And when those sorts of things happen, it's really important that you note down the information about that, how deep it was, what sort of pipeline it was, what direction it was going in, because that information can then inform future designers when they're doing something on that land as well.
I think you'll open a whole nother can of worms if we start to go down underground services and location of pipes and things.
But absolutely.
Hey, it's been great talking to you. Is there anything you would like to add talking about the application of this process that people, you know, would find really beneficial?
I think the key thing is that safety and design shouldn't feel like it's a burden. It should be something that makes sense and is making a more efficient process and a more effective outcome. Mm-hmm. If it's not doing that, you've done it wrong. Mm-hmm.
So I guess in trying to sum up, I guess, you know, the history of health and safety design came out of more industrial design, I guess, and with a safety focus for the end users, I guess, matches as the example, and oil pipelines. But we have the opportunity now to safeguard the places that we, you know, we live in and we work in for the future generations, and spending that time and effort now does create that legacy for the future. Is that how you see it?
Yes. And I'd like to think that if we're going to spend the money on a structure and putting something up, we want to make sure that it's something that's going to be effective in serving the people that want to use it. And hopefully we can make it fairly attractive for those walking past as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Kristen. Really enjoyed talking with you. And thank you for your time. You have been listening to Designing for the Greater Good, a health and safety in design podcast developed and presented by the Canterbury Safety Charter and the Professional Services Working Group. This is Paul Duggan signing off. Tune in again next time as we answer the question, is good design designing for the greater good?